Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Strange things happen when the horrors of war plummet the world into chaos. Soldiers and civilians alike report all sorts of bizarre and unexplainable phenomena in wartime, and sometimes they even report cryptid sightings. But these cryptids aren't like normal cryptids. They're darker, stranger. It's almost like they're at war when we are at war, or they get some kind of thrill from watching us fight. Today, we're going to dive into a few very strange wartime cryptid sightings and stories. As always, I'm your ghost, John. This is the 21CD Podcast. Let's get into it.
Hello citizen. Be advised this content creator is human and is therefore subject to human error. Remember, trust your government, consume appropriate content, and be cautious of all conspiracy theories as they are the tools of the rebellion.
Hey guys, welcome to the 21CD Podcast. If this is your first time here, welcome. As always, I'm your ghost, John. Before we get going, I'd really appreciate it if you guys would like, follow, and subscribe. These simple, free actions help my podcast grow and keep me driven to produce the best content that I possibly can. Some days, especially days like today, I just don't feel like I'm any good at this. And seeing you guys drop comments, likes, or subscribes, or just whatever, it really helps me out. I'm a pretty self-conscious person, so every little bit of support is it's what I need to keep going. If you're listening to me on a podcast platform right now, don't forget that you can find me on YouTube. I record all my videos in 4K. And if you guys are watching me on YouTube, but for whatever reason, you need a little bit more of a versatile podcast consumption experience, you can go ahead and find me on Spotify or Apple or pretty much any other podcast platform. Just put 21CD Podcast in Google and I'm sure you'll find something that'll work for you. As always, most of my updates are going to go out on Instagram. I do some dystopian camping, monster hunting, and filmmaking, stuff like that. There's more that goes into this than just these episodes. And you can find all those updates on the Instagram at 21CD Podcast. And one more thing that I want to mention, since YouTube stole all the money that this channel had made on account of me talking about things that they don't like because I said some stuff that basically painted the global elite in a slightly negative light, and YouTube is basically run by communist bastards, they demonetized my account and won't let me monetize it and took all the money that I had made and just took it. Because of all of that, I do have a Rumble account. You can find 21CD on Rumble, and that's where my band videos are. There's going to be more band videos going up. I know it because I'm doing sequels to the videos that were already banned. So if you're interested in that, you can go and find my Rumble. And also, if you want to support the podcast, I set up a Buy Me a Coffee, which is kind of new to me. I don't ask for money, but some of you guys have requested information on how to support the podcast. I am in the process of getting merch and everything, but it's an investment to do all that kind of stuff. So if you just want to buy me a cup of coffee, you guys know I love my coffee, you can do that. There's a link in the subscription above. And hopefully soon I'll also have a P.O. box set up, because some of you guys want to send me stuff, which is also new to me, but who doesn't like getting sent stuff in the mail? So soon I'll have a P.O. box, and then you guys can send me stuff, I guess. It'll be pretty cool, I'm not going to lie. You want me to wear your merch on the podcast? Why not? As long as I vibe with it, why not? All right, that's it for all the boring stuff. Today, we're talking about something pretty awesome, in my opinion. I was researching Dogman last week and found that crazy story about the Hound of Mons from World War I. And I figured, you know, a lot of sightings of cryptids do occur in times of conflict, confusion, just generally dark times, times where things just aren't quite right. Like even Mothman with the bridge collapse and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of cryptid sightings when people see cryptids, like when lots of people see cryptids around the same time, there's usually something weird going on in the world, or at least in that area. So I started thinking, and I was like, how many sightings occur in times of war? And the answer is actually quite a few. And I've got to be honest, the cryptids that are seen in times of conflict are kind of different than the ones that you might encounter in the woods while you're camping or going on a hike or walking your dog. They seem to be a little bit more intense, a little bit more like the stuff of a different kind of nightmare. And I'm not saying Dogman or Bigfoot or Mothman or dragons or nothing. I'm not saying none of that is shocking or a nightmare. But the ones that you see in times of warfare are just, they're different than the ones that you see normally, if I could say normally. It feels like a weird word, but a lot of us here believe in this sort of stuff, and therefore it is normal to us, so I use the word normal. But they seem to be a little bit more intense, like something here to almost watch us destroy each other and take advantage of the situation when we are behaving in our most inhuman ways. So I've got a few stories here. I've got three. They're kind of long. If you guys like these kind of stories, I can do more cryptids of wartime. The first one is about this cryptid called Old Green Eyes. And some people, this was a strange one to research, because some people thought Old Green Eyes was a ghost. And the accounts that I'm about to read you imply that he's a ghost as well. But I was seeing so many accounts of Old Green Eyes that made me feel like he was a vampire and not a ghost. I don't typically talk about ghosts, and maybe I'll have to do a ghost episode to sort of get into why I don't really talk about ghosts. But this Old Green Eyes, as I'm reading this, just know that even though these people might describe it as a ghost, in my opinion, it's very possible that Old Green Eyes is some kind of vampire, something that feeds on the dead in a strange way. It's a bizarre cryptid, and it's restricted to sort of one area, and let's get into it. So this article comes from the Northwest Georgia News and talks about this cryptid known as Old Green Eyes. These are the words of Edward Tinney, former historian and chief ranger at Chickamauga, Chattanooga National Military Park in Tennessee. Tinney, who worked at the park from 69 to 86 and also spent time working at the battlegrounds at Shiloh, Tennessee, said that ghostly sightings at the Chickamauga battlefield or any Civil War site are not uncommon. And I can attest, I've been to Gettysburg so many times, I've visited tons of Civil War battlefields because I used to be absolutely obsessed with the Civil War, still kind of am. There's a lot of crazy history, weird stuff happened during the Civil War, and obviously it's just a very important time in my country's history. But anyway, I digress. Tinney said that the legend of Old Green Eyes, This ghostly figure, who is said to haunt the battlefields in various forms, ranging from a Confederate soldier to a green-eyed panther, has been a part of Chickamauga battlefield lore since the last shot was fired at the bloody battle that claimed 34,000 casualties on September 19th through 20th, 1863. The tales of Green Eyes and other phantom sightings stem from the soldiers who lived through the war between the states. Green Eyes, according to some legends, is rumored to be some man who lost his head to a cannonball and is frantically searching the battlefield at night for his dislocated body. History says that ghosts in the battlefield, such as the Green Eyes tale, began happening soon after the war in 1863. Those who lived after the war are the ones who started the stories, he said. The more you got removed from the war or any kind of pain, the more glamorous it gets. That's kind of just how these type of stories go. Tinney says that wherever he's been, whether it's on the Civil War battlefield or in Europe where he fought in World War II, there are incidents and sightings that cannot be explained by human logic, right? Jim Carlock, an early resident of the Post Oak community, writes in McDaniel's book about returning home from a centennial celebration on Market Street in Chattanooga in 1876, a mere 13 years after the bloody battle. Carlock writes, "Did you ever see a ghost? They used to see them on the Chickamauga battlefields just after the war." And it's kind of crazy because we even have photos and videos of alleged ghosts on these battlefields. They're some of the most insane. I don't know if you can you call ghosts cryptids? I guess kind of, but like some of those videos and photos of ghosts on Civil War battlefields are kind of spooky because they're crazy looking. And I don't know how many of them are real, but like it is pretty crazy. But Carlock goes on to write that while passing through the battlefield, or near it, the exact location isn't exactly known. It was dark, and of course there were no houses nearby when he and his friend spotted something 10 feet tall with a big white head. He said he and his companions were in a wagon, and a Mr. Shields was riding horseback. Carlock said Shields rode up and hit the ghost, and a baby cried out, and the ghost said, "Let me alone." He said the entity appeared to be a ghostly apparition of a woman with a bundle of clothes on her head. Very interesting. And that's one account of this old Green Eyes. Now, obviously, this isn't occurring during the war. This is immediately after the war, but kind of the same thing. Although, if it's in 1863, this is still during the war. It's just after the battle. This is 1876. My bad. So, Tinney said that out of the 34,000 casualties killed or wounded at Chickamauga, only 4,000 were believed to have perished during the battle. But the historian does estimate that close to 70%, or almost 24,000 soldiers, perished from their wounds when the fighting ended. And that's just kind of the way it was in battles like this back then, because these weapons would absolutely brutalize the human body. If you didn't die upon impact, you would probably die of your wounds later from infection or just the severity of the damage that these bullets back then would cause, that these cannons would cause, that the shrapnel would cause. You would bleed out. I mean, people were absolutely torn to shreds in wars back then, and still are, but back then it was literally like having muskets that would shoot, you know, rocks at you, essentially. And yeah, so the wounds were just as bad as dying instantly. Probably a little more painful, though, but whatever. But the Civil War is not the only source of death that may have imprisoned lost spirits at the battlefield. The hill behind Wilder Tower saw the deaths of many soldiers, mainly from typhoid fever, during their training and encampment on the battlefield in preparation for the Spanish-American War. According to various sources, other tales claim Green Eyes existed before the Civil War and circulated among the soldiers during the fighting, or that the spirit existed as early as the Native American occupation of the land where the battlefield is now located. And those stories imply that he's some kind of hulking humanoid being with fangs and long black or ashen hair, and he would be seen sort of feeding on or hulking over these bodies during and after the Battle of Chickamauga. Tinney said that during his tenure at the park, he saw something one night that he could not explain and believes he came face to face with this creature inside the battlefield. The historian said that one day in 1976 at about 4 a.m., he went to check on some battle reenactors who were camping out in the park. He said that while walking near Glen Kelly Road, he encountered a man, over 6 feet tall, wearing a long black duster with shaggy, stringy, black, waist-length hair. And this thing, was walking towards him, and from the man's body language, Tinney feared that he was about to be attacked. So he crossed to the other side of the road, and when the man became parallel with Tinney, he turned and he smiled a devilish grin, and his dark eyes glistened. Tinney said that he turned to face the man and began to backpedal, and at that moment, a car came down a straightaway in the road, and when the headlights hit the apparition, it vanished. And other people have claimed to have this sighting as well, and this does not sound ghostly to me. This sounds like a being who is not trapped in this realm or something like that. This sounds like something that comes and goes and interacts with people in a sort of personal way, a lot like Dogman does, a lot like Mothman did, a lot like a lot of these cryptids do. But the thing is, this particular creature, if this is Old Green Eyes, has a history of feeding on the dead, or at least observing the dead in a peculiar way. So another story goes that Fort Oglethorpe resident Denise Smith, she said she encountered a ghostly being with green eyes on a cold, foggy night in the park in 1980. She said she had just gotten off work at the Crystal Restaurant in Fort Oglethorpe and was taking a shortcut through the park on her way to her home on Clio Drive. She crept her 71 Roadrunner slowly through the fog-enshrouded park about half a mile from Wilder Tower. And some of you guys might know where this is. I personally don't, but maybe you guys can go check this out for yourselves and tell me what you find. She says it was raining and foggy, so I was going real slow. I was going through the S-curve past Wilder Tower when I saw something big in the road, about eye level, and all I could see were these big green eyes. It was so foggy that I couldn't see the body. As I got closer, it just disappeared. She said she always thought the tale of the ghostly green-eyed beast was a myth, and never would have believed it in a million years, but now she won't even step foot in the park after nightfall. Pretty crazy stuff. I maintain that I think this is some sort of vampiric entity, something that profits from being around death itself, being around being in an area where a lot of death and violence has occurred. I say vampire because of some of the accounts that Civil War soldiers had where they reported seeing this thing literally sitting on corpses or hunkered over corpses, observing them, watching them fight, watching them die, and sort of appreciating the death. It's a strange thing. I could easily see how this is some sort of demonic entity, some sort of Nephilim, definitely not on the side of good. I mean, something on the side of good would not be so intrigued by death in this way, and probably wouldn't be drawn to places of such death. Just an idea. So is it possible that Old Green Eyes isn't a ghost at all, but something more of maybe like an otherworldly witness of hell on earth? Maybe it is something from the forces, from the ranks of evil that comes here to watch us kill each other and gets some sort of satisfaction or some sort of power from it. It's almost impossible to know. But one thing is for certain, it doesn't seem like tales of Old Green Eyes are found anywhere other than this battlefield, this Chickamauga battlefield area. So that's the first story. The second story I've got today comes from one of our troops that deployed to Afghanistan. And this story comes from Laura Roten. She's a paranormal researcher and filmmaker. And I was going to try to paraphrase this whole thing, but she wrote it so well that I'm just going to read it for you guys here. Obviously, I credit her, and you can find all my show notes in the description and stuff if you guys want to read it for yourselves. But the story goes like this. In 2006, I was deployed to Afghanistan from the National Guard as an embedded training team, or ETT. As an ETT, I was told I would deploy and augment soldiers in theater who needed plussing up. As an infantry, ranger, and special forces qualified soldier, I had the unique qualifications that they needed for working with the Afghan military. I received 30 days of subpar training and was sent in. Once there, I was given a sergeant first class as my second. His name was Jones, and he was a good man. We were then kitted up and attached to an Afghan infantry company of 125 soldiers to mentor their NCOs and officers in real-world battle conditions. We also served as their link to the U.S. forces for supply and support of all kinds. I was also assigned two contractor local nationals to serve as my interpreters. Initially, it was an odd experience being thrown into such a weird situation, but due to the autonomy my NCO and I were given, we enjoyed our time there. Eventually, I spent 2.5 years there, leaving in June 2009. A lot happened while we were there. Some of it was good, some of it was bad, and some very bad. But what follows was the oddest, to say the least. The Afghan people generally do not believe in spirits or other supernatural things, he says. They do, however, believe in jinns and angels, which to me are spirits or supernatural things, but whatever. Jinns are not like the Aladdin version, like the genies that you rub and they come out. Well, you don't rub the genies, do you? You guys know what I'm saying. They're bad news in real life and very vindictive, the equivalent of an evil spirit or demon. Well, on tour, I ran across a news story that said that rangers near Kabul had run into vampires, and if they had not had their trusty standard-issue bayonets with them, which for some reason had a plating of silver, they would have all died. The story was funny to all U.S. forces and to the Afghans, because no one believed it, and a lot of the story made no sense, such as bayonets having a silver plating. It was all BS, and we all knew it, but it did make us look twice in the dark. This was not alleviated by the stories Afghans would tell, stories of seeing movement in the dark and hearing sounds that made them worry. And we've all heard the stories, or a lot of us have heard the stories anyway, of the alleged giants that were found in Afghanistan as well. The Nephilim that we believe some of our soldiers were sent there to either kill or capture. While in the hills and mountains of Paktika province, which is next to the Pakistan border, we had been told by U.S. forces that anti-coalition militia, which later came to be known as the Taliban, were coming across the border at night through several valleys. The forces coming across the borders were reported to be working with Pakistan Border Patrol and were in no fear of discovery. We were told they numbered about 10 to 20 soldiers on foot dressed in light kit. Afghans had no love for the ACM, and for good reason. The ACM would extort, kill, and do unspeakable things to the locals. Afghan soldiers took their barbaric actions personally and would exact revenge any time they could without hesitation. The Afghan company was told to go recon the area and set up an ambush. It must be said that the Afghans did not have detailed plans like the U.S. forces did, and the order was basically go to this area and kill all the bad guys. As such, my NCO and I provided maps and communication for the operation. The Afghan company commander rarely joined the missions, and so I was effectively the company commander in the Afghan soldiers' eyes. We had three lieutenants in charge of three platoons and an HQ platoon, which I became the commander of due to being short of a fourth lieutenant. Sergeant First Class Jones worked closely with the First Sergeant. We basically were a family, and we respected each other. Before we even left to scout the area, one of the issues we had was to do with night vision goggles. Most of the Afghans didn't even have goggles, as the army didn't issue them, and I was only able to procure 5 sets. So I gave these to myself, Sergeant First Class Jones, and the 3 platoon leaders. Other than that, we shared the night vision goggles on guard duty and in battle. Once our mission began, we scouted the area and found signs that anti-coalition militia were using the area. Remember, this is that they would later become the Taliban, that group that would become the Taliban. Our first 2 ambushes were very effective. A U.S. infantry platoon was also in the area and were directed to support us. For the planned 3rd ambush, we found a new valley, supposedly in heavy use by the ACM. The U.S. platoon set up on the opposite side of the valley and had a clear field of fire up the valley to support us. During this 3rd ambush, the Afghan soldiers revealed that they had received warnings from local people not to go out at night because jinns were roaming the hills. We obviously ignored this superstition. Aside from not believing in that, we were heavily armed, so if they weren't jinns, they were probably just men, and we would be able to kill them. The kill zone that we had established was about 100 meters in front of us. We picked an area that would force them to go through an area that was clogged with brush and rocks, which would then guide them along a sandy, dry riverbed. I had 2 men further upriver stationed as an observation post with a radio. They never engaged unless fired on. They simply hid and reported by radio. At about 2 a.m., I got a report from the U.S. force saying that they saw movement at the head of the valley. My observation post, however, said they saw nothing moving. These reports kept coming in, but the Afghans continued to report no sign of movement. I was frustrated and assumed the U.S. troops with abundant night vision goggles would have been able to see better. My men, without goggles, were listening more than seeing. I was so frustrated that at one point I exposed myself and looked down the valley, and sure enough, I saw what looked like about 12 to 15 guys in white robes moving down the valley, fuzzy due to the night vision goggles. They were about 500 meters away. We prepared to ambush once we identified them. It was always my fear that I would ambush a bunch of drunk locals on their way home from a party, so identification was absolutely necessary before we acted. Yet, still the observation post reported no contact. Meanwhile, all the soldiers, including the U.S. infantry, were keyed up and awaiting on me to fire to initiate the ambush. Looking down the valley again, I watched in surprise as they walked right past my men at the observation post. They could not see them. It was then that I realized I could only see them when I looked through the night vision goggles. I ran all kinds of issues through my head. Do they have camouflage, which the goggles are cutting through? I could not understand it. They continued to head in our direction, entering the kill zone. The Afghan lieutenants were chomping at the bit to fire, yet I still could not identify. I tried to adjust my night vision goggles. Sergeant First Class Jones was also having trouble identifying them. Then, a shot sounded from my left, which I later determined to be one of the Afghan line soldiers from 1st Platoon firing by accident. That set it all off. We were committed. We initiated 2 claymores and open-fired as one. It's a beautiful thing when it all comes together. One moment you're almost deaf due to the quiet, and the next it's so loud you cannot hear someone yelling at you. I gave the green flare to shift fires, and the U.S. infantry platoon shot up the valley, and we charged into the kill zone like I had been trained as a cadet. I have to admit, I had nothing other than the actions at hand on my mind. Yet, as soon as it began, it all fell apart. The Afghans suddenly started milling around. A lieutenant started yelling for them to search the area. I arrived at the kill zone and I saw nothing, nothing at all. The U.S. platoon stopped firing. There was just smoke and nothing. In the quiet, we all looked at each other. The U.S. infantry was ready for counterattack, but none came. I then almost jumped out of my skin as Sergeant First Class Jones opened fire further down the riverbed and was charging and screaming like a madman. I followed him at a sprint, confused. It was then that I saw what he was chasing. It was one of the anti-coalition militia walking slowly away. I, too, began to fire, but as I and Jones got closer, we stopped. The figure that we had been firing at had no distinct shape and was not walking at all. It was floating. Floating about 2 inches off the ground, and it was approximately the shape and size of a person with black bands flowing through its milky white-green body. I assume it was white, but due to the night vision goggles, who knows? Jones and I watched as it continued on its way. It proceeded to float through a large boulder, simply continuing onwards. The thing that the Afghans later called a djinn paid us no attention and floated down the valley until we lost sight of it. I think I saw others ahead of it, but I'm not exactly sure. Eventually, I gave the pull-out order on my radio, and we all pulled out and prepared for a counterattack that never came. Afterwards, Jones never spoke of what we saw again and would look at you as if you were crazy if you ever mentioned it. Some hours later, I was talking to the U.S. Infantry platoon leader trying to figure out what had just happened, and he flatly said that he didn't see anything, and his unit only fired because we fired. He clearly did not believe that and was obviously covering his tail. It's also, I can't imagine firing at nothing. Like, usually the military is not just trained to start shooting when they hear shooting, so I imagine that either that's a lie or this guy did see something and he's just not admitting it. So I changed tact and talked to him hypothetically. He told me, hypothetically, that he saw white blobs moving in a file formation, which never stopped moving or slowed down from when we opened fire to when we stopped shooting. He hypothetically did not charge down into them and found nothing either. After interviewing all of the Afghan company and talking to the lieutenants, it came down to this. We saw somewhere from 10 to 12 silhouettes floating down the valley. When the ambush was initiated and we started firing, the djinns never paid any attention to us or even slowed down. About a week later, still confused by the incident, I talked to a USGS geologist who worked at one of the bases nearby and hypothetically asked him if he had an explanation for what happened. He suggested that the valley we were in had heavy iron and possibly magnetite veins in them, and what we may have seen was an electromagnetic ball of energy floating down the valley due to weather conditions, which were dry and hot. He stated it may have been something like a weak ball lightning, and the only reason we could see it was due to the night vision goggles. He gave an example of how helicopter blades look normal to the naked eye while moving, but if you look at them through night vision goggles, you see all the static electricity on them. Regardless of his given explanation, he did seem skeptical. As for the others who knew of the story, one of my interpreters quite soon afterwards told me that we were cursed. I reported that we conducted a live fire exercise for the locals to see after finding nothing and allowed the U.S. platoon leader to blame me for the wasted ammo. Also, extremely unprofessional. I wonder if this guy got in any trouble for doing that. Later, I reported to my U.S. ETT commander what really happened. He simply said it was a nice story, one to never repeat again. He told me he had seen others go down for less, and implied that he himself had seen and heard much weirder things happen. I never did report the truth, and I still have no idea what the things I called djinns were. They clearly had a human shape to them, and were not electromagnetic balls of energy. You know, there's a lot of stories that come out of Iraq and Afghanistan, the Middle East during our prolonged times of conflict there. There's stories of giants and Nephilim that special forces and rangers have encountered in caves where they have to go and basically fight these things and report how they are almost invincible and absolutely gigantic. There are stories of vampires that come out of Afghanistan and other places in the Middle East as well. And even a lot of the locals report these things coming out, living in caves and essentially preying on them. There's places where the locals won't even go because of the stories of vampires. And obviously the djinn is a horrifying cryptid that goes deep into history, and the tales are endless when it comes to gin and how absolutely dangerous they are. This, to me, sounds more like not a gin, maybe ghosts, maybe something else. Who knows what it is, really, to be honest. But pretty creepy nonetheless, and yet another example of strange stuff that appears to happen during wartime. And one of the things that both of these stories really make me wonder is, are these cryptids that are spotted during wartime here to observe us more than anything? Here to sort of referee the battlefield, if you will. Sort of observe, intervene if they absolutely have to. Like, we have tales of cryptids that seem to sort of be involved in warfare. One of these tales is coming here in the next story. But we also have stories of angels, like in the Hound of Mons story, where the angels appear to be watching over the British soldiers in the, what are they called, in their foxholes and in the ditches. It's pretty creepy and pretty interesting stuff. Can you imagine just sitting in your foxhole and just looking up and seeing some sort of angelic being sort of watching over you or one of your comrades or something like that? Or you're in the heat of battle and you just see something like an angel or some kind of apparition that seems to be engaging the enemy with you or flowing through the battlefield in a way that doesn't exactly make sense. I mean, it's crazy stuff. So the third example of cryptids making appearances during wartime brings us back to the Dogman theme. And I'm not going to lie to you guys, this is a weird one. It goes way back. But for all of you Dogman fans, this is going to be pretty cool. The Lombards, a formidable Germanic tribe, exerted their influence over vast regions of Italy from like the 6th century through the 8th century AD. Their history is rich with tales of conquest and strategy. It includes a particularly intriguing account recorded by Paul the Deacon, who was a renowned Lombard scribe. In their rise to power, the Lombards faced a daunting challenge because there was an immense tribal army, vastly outnumbering their own forces, and it had effectively blocked their path and presented a seemingly insurmountable obstacle. Like, they weren't getting through this tribal army. And yet it was in this moment of crisis that the ingenuity of the Lombard leaders shone through. So with a blend of cunning and psychological warfare, the Lombard chieftain devised a strategy that hinged not on brute force, but on the power of fear and superstition. He disseminated a chilling rumor among the enemy ranks, claiming that his forces included a pack of ferocious dog-headed warriors. These mythical creatures, he alleged, were not only formidable in battle, but also harbored a ghastly appetite for human blood. Moreover, the tale suggested that these beasts were so bloodthirsty that they would resort to cannibalism if they failed to reach their enemies. They would literally eat each other. This terrifying image of savage, half-man, half-beast soldiers struck fear into the hearts of the opposing army, as you can imagine, and faced with the prospect of battling such nightmarish foes, the enemy forces were gripped by trepidation. A psychological impact of this rumor was so profound that it swayed the course of events in favor of the Lombards, believing that confrontation with these monstrous allies of the Lombards would lead to a horrific, possibly supernatural combat. The enemy chose to avoid engagement altogether. And I know what you're thinking, like, they were just able to say that there were dogmen on their team and the other army was just afraid enough to run off and not even engage with them. That's what I thought too, but the story, that apparently during these battles back in this time, dogmen were actually widely talked about and widely feared. The Lombard leader turned the tide in their favor using a masterstroke of psychological manipulation, but that's because a lot of cultures back in this era were kind of privy to the fact that there were tribes of dogman creatures out there. The overwhelming army that had barred the passage of the Lombards chose to let them pass unchallenged, unwilling to risk an encounter with these mythical dog-headed warriors. This episode, though shrouded in the mist of time and legend, highlights the cunning and strategic acumen of the Lombard leadership, qualities that played a significant role in their rise to power in early medieval Europe. So, like I said before, it's easy for us to laugh at such a strange and unbelievable threat, but the world has undoubtedly changed a lot since these times. And back then, it was said that there were tribes of dogmen that seemed to be out and about and would kill humans and were absolutely ruthless. It was said that they speak no language, but bark like dogs, and in this manner make themselves understood by each other. Their teeth are larger than those of dogs, their nails like those of these mammals, but longer and rounder. They cannot be defeated in war. There was much talk of these war tribes of dogmen, so many that I have a few other accounts of them, which I'm going to go ahead and read for you now. Herodotus wrote in Histories 4, which he was a Greek historian in the 5th century BC, "For the eastern region of Libya, which the nomads inhabit, is low-lying and sandy as far as the Triton River. But the land west of this, where the farmers live, is exceedingly mountainous and wooded and full of wild beasts. In that country are the huge snakes and the lions and the elephants and bears and asps, the horned donkeys, the cynocephali, dog-headed men, and the headless men that have their eyes in their chests, as the Libyans say, and the wild men and women, besides many other creatures that are not fabulous." Pretty wild stuff, to be honest. It really does make you wonder what kind of creatures were in the world back then that we have exterminated by now. Cetaceus, wrote, and he was a Greek historian in the 4th century BC, "On these Indian mountains there live men with the head of a dog, whose clothing is the skin of wild beasts. And they speak no language, but bark like dogs, and in this manner make themselves understood by each other. Their teeth are larger than those of dogs, their nails are like those of these dogs, but longer and rounder. And they inhabit the mountains as far as the river Indus. Their complexion is swarthy. They are extremely just, like the rest of the Indians with whom they associate. They understand the Indian language, but are unable to converse, only barking and making signs with their hands and fingers by way of reply, like the deaf and the dumb. They are called by the Indians Calistri, in Greek cynocephali, dog-headed. They live on raw meat and number about 120,000. These creatures living on the mountains do not practice any trade, but live by hunting. When they have killed an animal, they roast it in the sun. They also rear numbers of sheep, goats, and asses, drinking the milk of the sheep and whey made from it. They eat the fruit of this Siptakhora. They eat the fruit of the Siptakhora, whence amber is procured, since it is sweet. They also dry it and keep it in baskets, blah, blah, blah. They exchange the rest for... They do all sorts of stuff. These are talented dog tribes, apparently. They also buy swords for hunting wild beasts, bows and arrows, and are very skillful in drawing the bow and hurling the spear. They cannot be defeated in war, since they inhabit lofty and inaccessible mountains. Every 5 years, the king sends them a present of 300,000 bows, as many spears, 120,000 shields, and 50,000 swords. They do not live in houses, but in caves. They set out for the chase with bows and spears, and as they are very swift of foot, they pursue and soon overtake their quarry. The women have a bath once a month. The men do not have a bath at all, but only wash their hands. They anoint themselves 3 times a month with oil made from milk and wipe themselves with skins. They have no beds but sleep on leaves or grass, and he who possesses the greatest number of sheep is considered the richest, and so in regard to their other possessions. All, both men and women, have tails above their hips, like dogs, but longer and more hairy. They are just and live longer than any man, 170 and sometimes 200 years. That's crazy. I mean, this was written the 3rd century BC? 4th century BC. Like, that's... why would you say something like that? Like, why would you have such detail, and why would you talk about something like that and write it down as history if there wasn't some aspect of it that was true? Like, were there actually dog men back then that were undefeatable in battle and had just an insane amount of weaponry and warriors? Pliny the Elder wrote Megasthenes. I don't know how to say these Greek names. I'm sorry, guys. It's really messing up my vibe here. But Megasthenes, I'm going to say, a Greek historian from the 4th century BC, states that in the Indian mountains, there is a tribe of human beings with dog heads who wear a covering of wild beast skins, whose speech is bark, and who live on the produce of hunting and fowling, for which they sew their nails as weapons. He says that they numbered more than 120,000 when he published his work. Wild stuff, man. Among the myriad of Christian legends, there's also this story, very intriguing. It's the tale surrounding Saint Christopher, the patron saint of travelers. His origin story is layered with various interpretations, but one of the most extraordinary narratives that I was able to find links him to a dramatic battle around 300 AD between the Romans and the Marmorate, a fierce North African tribe. Apparently, this North African tribe were notorious not only for their relentless ferocity in battle, but also for their unsettling cannibalistic practices. However, the most bizarre aspect attributed to them was their physical appearance. They were said to possess the heads of dogs. This peculiar characteristic set them apart in the annals of ancient tribal warfare and steeped their legacy in a blend of history and myth. In the heat of battle, which ultimately swung in the favor of the Romans, as many of those battles back then did, a towering figure among the Marmorate was captured. This individual, unlike any other, was a giant with the head of a dog and was known by the name Reprobus. The story of Reprobus from this point diverges into various paths, but a common thread in all versions is his conversion to Christianity. Adopting the name Christopher, which means bearer of Christ, Reprobus began a new chapter as a devout soldier of the Christian faith, and his journey as a Christian was marked by unwavering devotion, which ultimately led him to martyrdom in Syria. His extraordinary life and sacrifice led to his canonization, forever enshrining him as Saint Christopher, the reverend patron saint of travelers. The medieval Irish Passion of Saint Christopher offers a particularly vivid depiction of his origins, describing him as one of the dog heads, a race characterized by their canine heads and their gruesome dietary habits of consuming human flesh. This portrayal of Saint Christopher as a member of such a race not only underscores the diversity and complexity of medieval hagiographical, is that how you say it? What a dumb word. This portrayal of Saint Christopher as a member of such a race not only underscores the diversity and complexity of medieval hagiographical literature, but also reflects the era's propensity for blending fantastical elements with the spiritual narratives of saints. But the thing is, there's rumors that even after he passed away, you could still see his body for a time, and he had the head of a dog and was a giant. So, there you have it, folks. I mean, some pretty crazy stories. We've got a little bit of vampires, a little bit of giants running around, dogmen on the battlefield. It really makes you wonder how many of these things are weaponized in spiritual warfare at the same time that we are. And if when we are fighting, they are fighting and we just can't always see them, or when these soldiers are on the battlefield, are they under some kind of influence from these spiritual beings? That's just like the tip of the iceberg of stories that I found. Obviously, there are just countless stories when it comes to what people see on the battlefields, what people see around places where battles and wars have occurred. We've got all sorts of UFO activity that is seen around battlefields and even during wars. Lots of reports of orbs and strange electronic anomalies. We have ghost ships that are seen in times of battles, especially obviously naval battles. It just seems, maybe it's just the pure energy that it takes, that war takes in general, just the sheer amount of catastrophic energy. You know, a lot of people say that aliens really started coming when we dropped the atom bombs on Japan. They wanted to make sure, and that's why we're seeing so many of, you know, so many sightings of UFOs and potentially aliens as well today, because they're trying to intervene to make sure we don't destroy the planet. And I don't know what's going on, you know? None of us really know what's going on. A lot of us who listen to this podcast have some amount of faith, so we have an idea of what we think is going on, what we believe is going on. But the fact remains that there is a strange and different kind of cryptid sighting, cryptid experience, supernatural experience that occurs in times of battle when you compare them to your experience of Bigfoot or a regular dogman that you see when you're, you know, walking through the woods, or when you're seeing little people in the hills or elves in Iceland. It just feels different when it's around war. It feels much more spiritual, much more sinister in a way. It's all, I don't know. What do you guys think? If you guys are interested in more cryptids of wartime stories, let me know. I do have a few more. I still want to do that episode on the Hound of Mons, the Beast of Mons, because a weaponized dogman used by the Germans is just, how do you turn that down? So I'm going to have to do a full episode on that, and that's to come. We've also got that infamous tale of the, I can't remember if it was Special Forces or Rangers, who went and killed a Nephilim in the mountains of Afghanistan, but that's another crazy story. I know there's some others of soldiers in Afghanistan and other places in the Middle East who have experienced what seem to be UFO battles in the sky above them and stuff like that. There's just so many stories when it comes to wartime sightings. So if you guys want more of those, let me know. In the meantime, don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe. Thanks for all you guys do. Thanks for listening. And I will shout at you on Thursday. So don't drink the water and question everything. Later.